Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast with your hosts, Dr. Amandeep Hansra, Dr. Dana Pung, and myself, Dr. Elise Putt. Join us as we talk to inspiring clinicians who have redefined their careers. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Norman Swan, who most of you will know as a producer and presenter of The Health Report. Dr. Swan was born in Scotland, obtaining his postgraduate qualifications in paediatrics before moving to Australia. He's been with the ABC since 1982, having won numerous awards for his work on Radio National over the years. His career transgresses audio media into written and television journalism. In addition, he's recently published three books, starting in 2021 with So You Want to Know What's Good for You, 2022 with So You Want to Know How to Live Younger Longer, and most recently in 2024, So You Want to Know What's Good for Your Kids. We talk about all the things that have happened along Dr. Swan's journey to where he is today, how he's found the book writing process, and a little bit about his most recent book as well. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Dr. Norman Swan. Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast. Really excited to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I think a lot of people will probably know your name, but for those who don't, can you give us a summary of what you do currently?
So my day job is I produce and present two shows. One is called The Health Report on ABC Radio National, which is for who don't live in Australia, but maybe come from Britain. That's our equivalent of Radio 4. It's a national public service broadcast network. And I also do a podcast, both of these are co-hosted, by the way, called What's That Rash, where we answer listeners' questions in a fairly lighthearted way. And the only thing we don't answer questions on are rashes.
That's wise, I think.
I don't do any clinical work. I haven't done any for a while, but I trained in pediatrics.
Amazing. I'd like to go back there, back to your clinical days, and then I want to hear all about your career now. Do you remember what drew you into medicine in the first place?
The answer to that question is one of the ones people want to hear. I've wanted to help people all my life. I've dreamed of holding a lip-death stethoscope. That was not why I went into medicine. I couldn't work out what to do. Medicine was the easy option. I originally wanted to be an actor and go to drama school, which created World War III in my house. And I think they did me a favor, and I probably wouldn't have been that good. I couldn't work out what I wanted to do. And medicine seemed to be the training that would give me multiple options at the end. I could delay the decision.
And going through, you'd ended up doing pediatrics. Did you think you'd do pediatrics the whole time?
No.
Remember what brought that about?
I hadn't a clue. I still did a lot of acting and directing at university in the Drama Society. The subject I did best in was psychiatry. I decided I was going to do psychiatry. I actually applied for training schemes and got into one in Philadelphia at Temple University. But then I decided that I really wanted to get more clinical medicine under my belt, particularly pediatrics, because I was thinking of child and adolescent psychiatry. And I kind of lost the urge to do psychiatry, quite liked pediatrics. And like many stories in medicine, like for many people, a lot of this was influenced by the people who mentored you and trained you and you work for. Mm-hmm. And in Britain, we didn't do internships as such, like the way you do in Australia, where you rotate around every 3 months, different specialties. You do 6 months medicine, 6 months surgery in a firm. In other words, you work for one consultant or a team of consultants and their patients, and that's your job for 6 months. And then you have another 6 month job in surgery. And I really enjoyed my surgical term in London and had a great boss and did quite a lot of surgery. I'm a flibbertigibbet, you know, I just sort of dilettante and a tart, what some people would call it. And then I went on and I worked for an amazing pediatrician in West London called Dr. Finlay. At that time, there was a series called Dr. Finlay's Casebook, and he was a Scottish GP. Anyway, Dr. Finlay, this pediatrician, was Scottish as well. And he was just the most amazing doctor and instilled, you know, what you could actually get out of pediatrics. So I decided to run pediatrics. One thing led to another. And I applied for a registrar's job at the Children's Hospital in Sydney, Royal Alexandra, which is now the Children's Hospital of Westmead. And I came up for a year and stayed for life.
You said that you kept doing acting and directing through university. Did you keep that going while you were working as a doctor, or did it sort of fall to the wayside?
My story of career change and career development is one of recurrent frustration, at least in those early years. I was a bit of a nerdy kid when it came to theatre. So there was a very famous repertory theatre in Glasgow called the Glasgow Citizens Theatre, a pioneering theatre, and was considered one of the world's best exponents of Brecht and Ibsen. And I went to theatre by myself from about the age of 14 or 15. I saw Ibsen's last play there. One of the messages I got out of the play was, when you get to the end of your life, you don't want to regret stuff that you will wish you'd done. This changed my brain permanently. So I got into my adolescent brain, changed my neural networks into an anti-regret format. So I didn't want to get to my 50s, 60s or 70s, look back at my life and wish there was something else I'd done. Mm-hmm. So every so often, frustration came back. I got this frustration back that there was something else I wanted to do. I had to lay this acting course. So I did an audition for the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, which I failed miserably at. And it was embarrassing. You know, if I'd really been committed to acting, I would have got over that and gone and kept on doing auditions to get into a drama school. But I didn't. It was a revelation. Acting wasn't for me, I decided. And then when I came to Australia and I was working in pediatrics, this frustration came back. There was something else I wanted to do. I didn't know what it was, but I realized nobody was going to do it for me. This is another message I often give medical students. Nobody's going to deliver anything for you. You've got to make your own grind, make your own opportunity. And interestingly, one of the things I've thought about a lot is it's very hard to make massive changes. So for example, I'm sitting there doing one or two rosters, exhausted, and I want to become an actor. That is a massive jump. It's not an adjacency, it's a massive jump. Mm. And what I've realized is to make change, you've actually got to move into an adjacency where the jump is less dramatic. It'll look dramatic, but it's less dramatic because you got yourself into that place. And so it was just too big. I really enjoyed the job. I enjoyed the pediatrics, but there was something else I wanted to do. They were very kind to me. I decided to take a gap year, which nobody ever did in those days. And they were very kind to me. They kept me on part-time as a registrar. And I did different things, consulting. I started trying to write. And nothing happened with my writing. I really got to break this mold. So I decided that I'd start to write about what I knew about, which was health. And I got something published, which actually instituted a government inquiry in New South Wales into an organization called the Royal Far West Children's Scheme, which is a very different organization now than it was then, where they were basically stealing kids from the country, Aboriginal kids, non-Aboriginal kids, keeping them there in Manly. It was a very toxic organization, which I hasten to add, it's not now and has reformed. So I thought, well, this is my great new career, I can write. And then it stalled. Nobody seemed to be impressed. So this doctor wanted to give up medicine to be a writer. And I was doing my tax return for a couple of years, all this stuff and medicine, kept it all going. And then I was doing my tax return and I'd earned $800 out of writing. And I decided the world wasn't waiting for me. So I was going to go back to full-time medicine. And those are the days when you actually had newspapers and you actually had things called classified ads. And I opened the newspaper on a Saturday morning. That's where the big classified ads were. And I was just casually glancing at the classified job ads. And there was a job ad for a producer to make science and medical programs for ABC Radio. And if somebody had ever asked me, which they never did, what's your dream job? That actually would have been it. And I applied for it and got it.
Wow. That's insane. I feel like that's a very different journey to what I was expecting. The fact that you had that period where you were really fighting to get into the field and not feeling like it was really working for you. What did you actually do? How did you approach getting published? Was it just you literally going to newspapers or that well?
I didn't either. I had no clue. I had no contacts. Through my experience at the Children's Hospital, I knew about the problems with the Royal Far West Children's Scheme. So I wrote it up and I sent it in on spec to a paper that doesn't exist anymore called the National Times. And they took it. You know, I won a Gold Walkley 4 years after joining the ABC, maybe 5 years, for an investigation into scientific fraud. And a gynecologist called Dr. William McBride, I knew there was a problem with him. And I continued looking at it when I got into journalism. So a lot stemmed in those early days from my real life experience of pediatrics. But I just sent it in on spec. I had no training in writing. When I wrote a piece, I couldn't tell a good piece from a bad piece. That took a lot of time for me to learn to look at my writing self-critically.
When you took that job at the ABC, was it full-time? Did you leave clinical medicine at that point or did you keep going doing part-time?
I decided if I was serious about journalism and writing, I could no longer do it part-time. I was doing it part-time. I was doing all sorts of different things, including getting my membership with the Royal College of Physicians during that time. I don't have my FRACP, but I've got my British membership. And I had to do it full-time in an organization where I'd learn how to do it and do it properly. And then I could decide, I hate it, I love it, do I want to continue in it? But just messing around on the periphery wasn't going to cut it. And so it was full-time. It was a decision I had to make, which was, again, comes back to this adjacency. If I'd been working in full-time pediatrics as a registrar at the Children's Hospital, and this opportunity came up, that leap would have been quite big. But I was already half out, half in for a year or two. So to make a jump into leaving pediatrics, at least for a while, which is one reason I got my ticket. I just wanted something to fall back on if it didn't work out. By the way, getting my ticket, as I also say this to medical students, is don't just get a bare medical degree. Nobody really respects that. What got some response from the interviewing committee was I'd actually gone on and done up 2 postgraduate qualifications. Mm. So you've done a bit more. Because what they're looking for is self-drive. Can you get going? I actually stayed on doing pediatrics at the weekends as a safety net. But also my first salary was $19,000 a year. And even then, that was not very much money.
I love that advice, the adjacency. That's excellent. I feel like that we hear a lot of the same themes come through as I have these conversations. And that feels like a new one. So it's impressive. When you started that job, how did you feel initially? Did it feel really challenging going from clinical medicine to a new environment? Or did it immediately feel like it was perfect for you?
Well, I was terrified, first thing. incredibly humbled. I knew I didn't know anything. I was very careful. I instantly felt this is where I should be. So it was the ABC, public broadcaster, no commercial influence. The drive was towards quality and depth, discussing what we do, getting feedback, learning from others on the job and apprenticeship. It just felt right and has felt right ever since. I mean, the ABC can drive you nuts in terms of how it's managed and so on and so forth. If you keep your eyes focused on the audience and why you're there, and you can ignore, as many hospital doctors do or general practitioners, keep focused on the patient. In my case, keep focused on the audience and the challenge gets you through. So I decided I just had to work harder than I'd ever worked before, get up to speed as quickly as possible. I wasn't there to mark time. I wasn't there just to wait for stuff to come along. I was taking any opportunity to be on air in front of a microphone, do stuff, do different things, do public current affairs reporting, and learn as quickly as possible. I looked for the people who got stuff to teach me. And I actually ended up working much harder than I was in medicine.
Oh, that's interesting. And now you obviously have evolved over the time that you've been there. I mean, you've gone from radio to podcasting.
My core is still radio. I realize not many people who are listening to this podcast still listen to linear radio, but I'm a linear radio devotee, with all due respect to this podcast. And I'm a podcaster as well. You know, listening to only podcasts because you limit your discovery. By listening to linear radio, you discover interests that you never knew you had. And you get surprised. My core job is linear radio. We've been doing podcasting and Radio National before there was a word for it. But as soon as the internet came along and we went online on Radio National, we would be getting 70 or 100 million downloads a year of downloads of what you would today call a podcast. So that online audience was incredibly important. And being accessible was really important and entertaining and all that. And then televisions as well. So I've never been starry-eyed about television and avoided making the jump full-time to television. I just think radio is a very good home to have. And then I can do television at my choice. So I do 7:30, I do occasional Four Corners. So I like television. I like the impact you've got, but I like radio more.
That's interesting considering your initial roots in loving acting. You would have thought that the television would come through, but obviously the radio satisfies that side of you as well.
There's a great tradition of radio drama. I mean, at one point I ran Radio National. So I come back to that management experience I had when I took my year or two off, where I was doing management consulting for a friend. And I learned a lot of the principles of management and strategic planning. And I actually like that sort of stuff. Internally, the ABC, I was a strong critic of the way Radio National was going. So they called my bluff and put me in charge of Radio National for 3 or 4 years. And I changed it quite radically. That was another adjacency, being willing to change and then put your money where your mouth is. You're always remembering where your home is and what you're best at.
I'm interested to hear a bit about how your writing's evolved over that period as well. You've obviously started out writing news articles, and now you're doing that as well as writing books and probably some other things along the way as well. You talked about how it was a lot of trial and error and learning to criticize your own work. How did the books come about, and how do you find writing as a process now?
Well, I think writing for people who are outside the business don't appreciate how much in both television and radio is in the writing. Obviously, it's important in films, drama, and so on. It's also important in documentaries and nonfiction. So the core skills that I learned very early on was writing for radio, writing for vision, communicating with an audience, telling stories, editing your own work so you're using as few words as possible. It's a juggle and it's painful getting criticized, reading my scripts to people, getting feedback. Over a 2, 3, 4 year period, I learned to be concise and economical in my writing. And once you can do that for a 30-second radio script or a 44-minute four corners, even now, after all these years, my producer's giving me stick for my writing, the executive producer's giving me stick for my writing. We, in four corners, there's an associate producer whose sole job is to edit scripts and comes back and saying, what the bloody hell are you talking about here? Even now, I get feedback on communication, concision, making sure you're taking the audience with you. And then to start doing that on a larger scale for a book, just putting enough of yourself into it, not too much, having humor, knowing what keeps people there, because the key is to keep people listening. So they come in after the news, you've got a 1 hour show, you want them there at the news at the next hour. And then there's all sorts of tricks for doing that. Humor, surprise, metaphors that you might not think about, ways of explaining complex issues. What I really love doing is translating complexity without losing depth for a lay audience. So I don't broadcast a doctorate. I focus on the lay audience. What I'm doing for them, at least when it comes to my health broadcasting, is giving them information. I started doing this in the early 80s. Nobody in the media was doing this for the general audience. Here's me giving you stuff as an ordinary person in the street that doctors have only had before, and some doctors don't even have it now. And it would drive some doctors nuts. The patients would come in with a transcript of my show and the references. I mean, that's commonplace now, but it wasn't commonplace then.
Can you give me a sense of how much work goes into creating a 1 hour show? Like how many hours of how many people's time goes into that 1 hour?
Well, if only we have a cast of millions. I've got one producer and I've got a co-host, Priya Alexander with The Health Report and Tegan Taylor with What's That Rash? And so we have a longish program meeting. We have a certain format, which is we cover health news and then we go in depth in some interviews. And then we chew the fat. We talk about all sorts of things that might be around. We have a long list of stories we might do. The producer goes and books interviews, which we do during the week. And by the time Thursday comes along, by then we know what we're going to do for news. We have a bit of a table read. We write a script, then we record it, and then the producer edits. So it's a team of three. Fantastic producer called Shelby Trainer. My broadcasting takes probably, in terms of physical time, maybe 3 days a week.
Wow. And I'm sure you've gotten faster at a lot of that stuff over the years as well.
That's right. And the technology's helped. In the old days, we had tapes and you were sticking the tapes together and little cutting with a razor blade, very incredibly slow. So you can cut. I mean, the other day I cut a very difficult interview, 10 minutes down to 5, and it took me a little over an hour. That would have taken me half a day before just because of the technology differences.
Mm. It's really interesting to hear how much the writing comes into that, because that certainly as an outsider, I wouldn't have thought about that and how much that's actually improved your writing over the years as well. When you sat down to write that first book, did you have a particular structure of how you did it? Did you set aside time for it? Or did you feel like it was constantly writing itself on the back of your brain when you weren't doing it?
Writing a book is hard work if you do it well. So the first book is so you think you know what's good for you. So you've got to have a driver behind that. What do you want to do? And so I've got a literary agent and I've got a publisher. And it wasn't readily apparent what I was going to do with that first book. I'd always refused book offers in the past. We workshopped a lot. They wanted a kind of medical encyclopedia that you would have as a whole medicine manual on the shelf at home, which still might sell, but wasn't particularly what I wanted to write. I knew what I wanted to write. I wanted to debunk the whole health industry and give people the evidence for health and well-being, get rid of the bullshit. What do you focus on? Covering all sorts of areas that you're going to be interested in, from nutrition to activity to mental health, well-being, and so on. So structure is everything in my view. I didn't start writing until I had a set of chapter outlines. So I knew what the structure of the book was, not necessarily which chapter went where, but I knew the headings. That changed a little bit as time went on, new things emerged, but that gave you the structure that you could follow. And then the discipline is talking to people who write. The general advice is you write every single day and you try not to miss a day. And it doesn't matter how much you write, you've actually got to write every day. So I'd get up at 5 and write. And I wasn't fussed whether it was 500 words or 1,000 words. I also wasn't fussed whether there were 500 good words. Most doctors are obsessive compulsive neurotics. I'm speaking for myself, not for you.
That's true.
And you want to make sure everything's right and so on. But it can be your worst enemy as well. You've got to learn a bit of looseness there. And the temptation is you write something and then you go back and you edit it. So it's famous in film writing. New film writers never get beyond the first two or three scenes. They're always going back and rewriting. And you just got to push on, get stuff done, and leave the editing till later. Mm. And yeah, sure, if it's not working. And so I just push on. And if you actually divide 90,000 words by 500-700 words a day, it becomes a manageable task. Then you spend a lot of time going back and editing basically all the shit that you've written and rewriting it. It needs to be rewritten and put into place and things moved around. And somebody recommended a really good writing program. Possibly the best advice I'll give you is don't write in Word. There's a program called Scrivener, which is designed for writers, and it's fantastic. So for example, book structure goes on the left-hand side, so you see where your chapter headings are, and every chapter has a corresponding file folder for your research. So there's no going hunting. I want to go back to my piece on oxidative stress. Boom, I'm there in 1.5 seconds. I want to check the references. Boom, I'm there in another 1.5 seconds. And just like the technology of radio, it shortens the period of time for writing because you're not scrolling through a continuous document.
Yeah, I imagine that's especially important for the sort of books you're writing, where you're using a lot of resources and references.
It's important for fiction as well, because fiction, sometimes the flow of the story doesn't necessarily match and you need to move around things. And famously in film writing is you have these story elements and you think you understand where the story elements go, but in the old days, they would have flashcards. This is where you get shot, blah, blah, blah. And you put them up on a board and you work out how the story flows with all these individual elements.
Then you went on, after that, you've written 2 more books. So You Want to Know How to Live Longer. And then your most recent one is So You Want to Know What's Good for Your Kids.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And you're holding a copy up right now for those who can't see this. Can you tell us a bit about the most recent one?
The recurrent theme in all 3 books is it's the volume of information that's out there online. It's not knowing what to trust or who to trust and getting confused. So when you take this one, which is about grandparents and parents, because grandparents are doing a lot of the childcare in this world and getting very frustrated because they don't agree with what their kids are doing, but they're not sure whether they're right or wrong. And the kids say, you know, okay, I want you on a Friday, but you're not allowed to do anything. This is what you're going to do. So grandparents are very frustrated. You don't know who to believe or what to believe. And it's a confusing area. Essentially, what I wanted to do was do the hard work for people, which is what's evidence-based, what's not, what works, what's not, in child development, child rearing, parenting, nutrition, and what have you. And get rid of the bullshit. In other words, and I give people references, there's a lot of references, so they understand, so that we can rely on the information there. And then I've given each chapter to a subject matter expert to read and come back to me as a fact check, also a nuance check. And also dealing with some of the difficult issues that the perplexed doctors as well, GPs and pediatricians, autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, depression, anxiety. So, and it's also for kids not to 10. There are plenty of books on the market for the early years, plenty, and many of them are very good. And there are plenty of books on adolescence, but there's almost nothing on the middle years. And the middle years used to be called the salad years. Don't worry when they go to school, to get to high school, it's the salad years, enjoy them while you can for the dark days of adolescence to set. So the problem is, they're not the salad years. There are incredibly important developmental years. They've been under-researched, poorly understood. And what I pulled together here is, in addition to the early years, what's understood about these important years of early to mid primary school? Because a lot's going on. There are 2 periods of acute brain plasticity in our lives. One is the first 2 years of life. And the second period is starts around about 8 or 9 years old and goes through into adolescence. So in the first 2 years, your brain is overgrowing. Years of the middle years, your brain is being reshaped, it's being pruned. And it's being pruned for adulthood, and it's being pruned forever. The ability for you to experience major brain plasticity after adolescence is not minimal, but it's much harder to do. And what are we doing? we are giving kids the most addictive technology we've known, next to nicotine and heroin, screens. And they're changing children's brains. When I started writing this, I thought, I was skeptical of the data on eating disorders in children in primary school and anxiety and depression. I thought anxiety and depression was a parental thing, that parents were getting better at recognizing it. So I'm not talking about parental neuroticism. I'm talking about they understand what anxiety is. They look for help, can't find it, frustration, therefore you hear about it a lot. But it's a real rise, so it hasn't been seen before. And eating disorders is just new. It's not there before. And the other thing that's new is the extent of challenging behaviors. You talk to people, you know, early childhood educators, primary school teachers, they've not seen the challenging behaviors that they're seeing now. So a lot is happening in that time. And I try and explain that in the book and give people some solutions.
It sounds more topical than ever, both with the spreading of misinformation on the internet and just the rise of all of the change in the world with screen time and access of information for kids as well.
The screens themselves are a problem. Time spent on screens, and it's not necessarily social media. Your kids are in a WhatsApp group. You've made the mistake of giving them a mobile phone when they're a child. All that stuff about upward comparison, comparing yourself to others, the anxiety of where you sit in the world, it's appalling. It's truly appalling, and they're addicted.
I was going to ask you for your key takeaway from the book, which I'm sure there's more than one, but is there one key message that you wish you could share to parents? And I feel like it may be what we've just talked about, but
I think for parents, the message is still very simple. But think of parenting on several continua. So one is cold to warm. And you don't want to be a cold parent and unemotional, not giving your child stuff. And you want to be a warm parent. You love your child and you're there for your child and so on. But if that's all you are, so cold parenting, harsh parenting, disciplinarian parenting, associated with poor outcomes, depression, anxiety, maybe drug use disorders and so on. What could be bad at warm parenting? Child who gets ultra warm parenting with no discipline, no boundaries, ends up being, and this comes from longitudinal studies, this is not me inventing it, ends up being an entitled adult who doesn't complete stuff. They go to university, they don't complete their degrees. When they get a job, they know better than everybody else how to do the job after a week, and they don't get renewed on probation. Overlaid on the cold to warm scale is boundary setting, discipline, expectations. It's considered, oh, I don't want to set expectations for my child because it will turn them into a neurotic wreck. Bullshit. The child who knows what expectations are of them has lower levels of anxiety and is happier, because what children want is consistency, routine, and predictability in everything that they do. And if you leave them to themselves to learn in an unstructured environment, you are asking for trouble. The third layer is protection. We all want to protect our kids, but if we overprotect our kids, then they don't learn to make decisions for themselves and they don't learn autonomy. And that also increases anxiety.
It sounds like from everything, you've put a lot of work into your books, obviously, but does everything that you've done up until that point inform it as well? Or what is the research process like when you are tackling a new subject matter and a new book?
I thought this one was going to be easy because, you know, I'm trained in pediatrics. I kind of knew this stuff. I sit on a board of the Australian Research Alliance for Children and Youth. So across this stuff, boy, this was hard. The stuff I didn't know that I should have known was a lot. There was a lot of research, a lot of correcting of my own prejudices. I developed this format in the first book, which I've kept, which is to save people time. So I write a paragraph at the beginning, which is, these are the key takeaways from this chapter. If you're interested, read on. And then I can reiterate at the back. And that comes from radio writing and television writing. You've got to write an intro. So what I've learned over the years is you've got to write an intro that grabs you by the neck, sits you down and said, you're not going anywhere else for the next 5 or 10 minutes because I've got this really interesting story to tell you. So I do that in each chapter. And writing that paragraph tells me what the rest of the chapter is going to be like. And that's the hardest bit of the writing, is writing that paragraph, because that becomes the arrow through the story. And, you know, Mark Twain said, sorry, I wrote you a long letter. I didn't have time to write you a short one. Understanding what the message is and then sticking to that. And if it's not the right message, going back and rewriting that initial paragraph so that it flows clearly.
Yeah, that's so interesting how much your radio work has informed the books as well. I wonder how different it would have been if your content would have been if you'd gone straight into writing. Now, my final question is a question that we ask everyone that comes on the podcast. You've already done a lot of different things, but our question is, if you could do something else outside of the roles that you've currently done outside of medicine, do you have an alternate reality dream career, something that you've never pursued or maybe not successfully pursued?
I'd still like to try my hand at professional acting or directing.
Are we talking theatre or...?
I love the theatre and I think you get immense training there. So I'm not beguiled by the big screen. So theatre or film or television.
Oh, well, I look forward to your acting career. Yeah, I hope to see it in the future.
We'll see.
Thank you so much for joining us. You've had such a creative career. Very exciting to hear all about it.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast, a proud member of the Talking Health Tech podcast network. We hope that we'll see you at our upcoming conference, which is taking place Saturday, August 23rd and Sunday, August 24th in Melbourne. We will be bringing together inspiring speakers from all walks of medicine and an equally inspiring audience that we'd love to have you as a part of. Follow us on socials and subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss any announcements. The Creative Careers in Medicine podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognises the continuing connection to lands, water and community. We pay our respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and elders past, present and emerging.